So the broad theme of the lectures, because I know it's coming and going in the audience just very briefly, is the focus is on how far speech is an enabler of thought, how far it's a transformer of the sort of mind that speaking minds are. And the thesis, in a way, is that there are a number of important capacities, mental capacities, and the next are really moving more to interactive capacities like commitment, personhood, and responsibility, which are not presupposed, so I suggest, to language, but which language catalyzes or brings on stream. And in order to sort of support that thesis, the sort of background picture has been a genealogy, if you like, of a kind of factual genealogy, thought experiment of thinking about a community of creatures like us in all sorts of ways that don't have language. Imagine they get language, and we talked about that in the first lecture, of a very basic, simple information exchanging sort. And the argument of the first lecture was that creatures like that, like us essentially, would, by dint of having language, they would be able to make judgments, say things sincerely and with a degree of care. And in doing that, it would be manifest to all that they would have corresponding beliefs. That being the case, they'd be in a position where they could decide to form a belief on this question or that question, whether P is the case, whether Q is the case, think about the data, and if the data are available, make a judgment, privately or publicly, to the effect that P, and on the whole, be fairly confident that in doing that, they will have come to form, if they didn't have it before, or confirm, they'll certainly have ensured that they have a belief corresponding to that. In normal circumstances, there is somewhere it may break down. I give an example where, you know, I get persuaded of the gambler's fallacy, that it's a fallacy, but when I go to the casino, it just doesn't catch. It hasn't really caught in the form of a corresponding belief. So that was the first lecture. The various other aspects to it as well. Then this last day, I talked about how these creatures would also, by dint of having language, have both a motive and a means of reasoning, as I described broadly in the image, because many of you are familiar with it here, of John Broome's picture of at least theoretical reasoning, which requires what he calls a linking belief. I may give that a somewhat different gloss from him, but the idea is that in moving to, say, Q from P, and if P then Q, you have to have a sort of awareness of the content of P, and if P then Q, that makes it the case that you think of them as eliciting the belief that Q, as making that more or less inescapable. You don't just pass from having the belief that if P and if P and P to the belief that Q, as if, you know, by magic. You pass through it in virtue of recognizing that the contents of those beliefs, and we're not talking about suppositional reasoning, we're talking about actual reasoning, the content requires that movement to Q. So it's not just P, if P, then Q, and then you find yourself thinking Q, you think, so Q. Okay, today I want to suggest that language is also going to precipitate or bring on stream, make almost inevitable, it need not be totally inevitable, there's no claim to that effect, the appearance of a novel dimension to consciousness. Now, I've said that in some of these seminars, or rather lectures, I'm really having to do a quick incursion into areas where I am no expert. Probably on each topic, there have been people in the audience who know more about that particular topic and the literature around it than I do. That's particularly true today, but especially with Mike Martin in the chair, but well, here goes. So you have a handout. So first section where I want to argue is this. Insofar as we do make a judgment, say that P or whatever, and can be confident it's not a casino-like case, and it manifests to us and to everyone, that we thereby believe, we come thereby to believe that P, insofar as that's the case, and insofar as we know what we're doing in making such a judgment, then I say, you're going to believe consciously that P. So by virtue of bringing the belief on stream, by means of making a judgment, which is language dependent as I'm thinking about it, you actually come to form the belief consciously rather than unconsciously. Now, we talked about agency in the first lecture and the idea that any very simple agent is going to have representations or beliefs about its environment. They are needed to direct its actions in pursuit of its purposes, even this little simple robot I talked about. But such a creature may have that belief totally unconsciously. There may be no sense in which it's aware of the belief, aware even the content of the belief. It's just aware of the objects in its environment, and the beliefs are doing the job of channeling it, enabling it to navigate those objects. But if you can make a judgment, and the judgment brings a belief on stream, and you know what it is to make a judgment, you will know that you have that belief. You'll have, you might call it a maker's knowledge of that belief, because you've made up your mind on that issue, to use the phrase I used earlier. And making up your mind that P, and thereby coming to believe that P, and knowing that you've made up your mind, you will know that you believe that P. Now, of course, I did put in an if there, an assumption that we know what we're doing in making a judgment. But I take it that in making a judgment on whether P, a whether judgment, as you might call it, we have obviously, in order to do that intentionally or intendedly, as I've said, you've got to know what you're doing. You can't do something with intention without knowing what you're doing. So you're going to know what you're aiming to do in making a judgment as to whether P, and the fact that you end up judging the P as a result of the process you put yourself through, the sight put yourself through, you're going to know that it emanates in that judgment as well. It's not as if it's far downstream. So I take it you are going to know what you're doing in judging the P, and therefore you're going to know that you believe the P. So that means that wherever you got maker's knowledge of a belief, because you've made up your mind, you're going to believe what you believe consciously. You're going to know that you believe and what you believe. You can put it in words. Okay, I also want to argue that, and this goes back to the reasoning theme in the second lecture, that when you take your guidance from certain premises, you think P, if P then Q, and then, so Q, or the example I used, you think, here's someone who says he has no brothers or sisters, I have none, but that man's father is my father's son. And, you know, as you work through those premises as they are, you're going to think about, I'm the only person, I've got no siblings, that man's father is my father's son. Well, I'm the only son of my father, so that man's father is my father's son, has to be me, so it has to be my son. What you've been thinking about is the situation described in those premises. And you then believing about them, what you might express by saying that they elicit the belief that it's my son, you know, as in the light goes on, or it's the person, the speaker's son. At that point, you also have had to have consciously come to believe the premises. So not just the belief you make up your mind about, that that's the speaker's son, with the premises you start from, you have to believe also in a conscious way, because you will have spelled out what those are in thinking about them, as I said, and be led thereby to the conclusion. It's not just, so I call that, just for want for a mnemonic, taker's knowledge. So you've got taker's knowledge of a proposition when they serve as premises for some conclusions that you draw. Now, that taker's knowledge is important because not only do we reason from other things that we believe to conclusions, we also reason from perception. We reason from how things present themselves to us, or at least seem to present themselves to us in the various modes of perception. So, for example, I look at a bird outside my office in All Souls, and I wonder, is it a dove or a pigeon? And I try to think about the different shape and color of a dove and a pigeon. I came very bad on this stuff. But, you know, I've got to think about that bird as perceived by me and on the basis of what I make perceptually salient, be drawn to the conclusion, oh, of course, It's a dove, right? Because it doesn't have the, whatever it might be, the pecking action of a pigeon or whatever. Or, you know, with all sorts of other examples, someone hands me something in the dark, and I wonder, what on earth is it? And it's got sort of funny, it's round, I can see that. And it's got a sort of furry outside, and it's got a sort of smell, and these are all properties of it. And I think, hey, it's a tennis ball, right? I just get it, right? In those cases, you're reasoning from how you perceive things to be. And therefore, I say, by virtue of that taker's knowledge, you consciously perceive things to be thus and so. And of course, unconscious perception is at least perfectly coherent as a notion that something is exposed to you perceptually through one of the senses, and without you being aware of what you're seeing, it just induces a belief. But not in the case where you reason from perception, or you've got taker's knowledge of it. Now, of course, I'm going to talk about reasoned perception, but I don't for one moment mean to suggest that in every case of the sort of perception I'm talking about, there's active reasoning going on. Obviously, most perception is much more quick, so to speak, than that. It just happens in an instant. You leap to conclusions, so to speak. You don't have to think about them. But as I suggested the last day, something like reasoning can control a process, even when it's not actively involved. So I gave the simple analogy of the cowboy driving the cattle to the railhead. He does nothing, strums the guitar, the cattle follow their head, he ends up at the railhead. Did he control them going to the railhead? Well, of course, because had any one of those head of cattle gone a different or wrong direction, he would have been alerted, he would have put it back on track. Similarly, reasoning may be in control of our perception in the sense that we automatically form beliefs, but red flags go up sometimes. You know, I say, that can't be Johnny, we say, some friend you thought you saw. And then you check, you know, and then you really reason from what was it you noticed that made you think Johnny or Mary was there. So it's a reason perception, I mean, where reason is in control in that sense. Now, I'm interested in this perceptual consciousness, the sort of consciousness that's associated with having a taker's knowledge of what you perceive, because you're at least in a position to reason from what you perceive to what you, so to speak, ought to believe, to how things are, if the perception is to be taken at face value. But in order to, and the reason I'm interested in it, of course, is that we know conscious belief, conscious desire for that matter, it doesn't seem to have much of a quality about it, you know, that sort of feel, that buzz, you know, that we associate with consciousness, and particularly in the recent literature, like people like Galen Strawson and David Chalmers and so on, they sort of, there's a buzz there that they savor in when they talk about consciousness. There's no buzz really to conscious belief, but you might think there's a sort of buzz to conscious perception, you know, that there's some way, something it's like to perceive consciously, even if there's nothing, although they deny that, even if there's nothing it's like to believe consciously, there's something it's like to perceive. So that's why I'm interested in exploring it. And I'm going to do that in the next few sections. But first, I'm going to just lay out some assumptions about perception. Now, as I say, I'm not an expert in this area. I think these assumptions are a fairly high level, so they're consistent with variations at a greater level of detail. And the assumptions I'm going to describe as the DAD, as in dad assumption, D for directness, A for attentional, and the third D, the second D rather, for disallowable. So let me explain what I have in mind. I'm going to grab some water first. The directness that I assume perception has comes in two different forms. One is that, and this isn't so important from my point of view, I take it that when you perceive an object, it really is that object that you perceive, not anything in between, not as in traditional sense datum or even a part or a side of the object. And that's because when we think of perceiving an object, we think of what you perceive as something that you continue to perceive as you move around it, as the light changes, as you move from, say, looking, seeing, to touching, for example, that it's still the same object you're perceiving. And I take it that that is, at least in the case of veridical perception, I'm going to say very little of a non-veridical perception, which is a very tricky topic, as everyone in this audience and in Oxford knows, I suspect. Okay, so you perceive the direct object. That's one aspect of the directness. But the more interesting question bears on the property that you perceive something as having. Now I'm going to assume, or at least I'm going to concentrate on the sort of perception, maybe it's most perception, which is classificatory or predicative or ascriptive, whatever your word might be, which is to say, I'm thinking of perception when you perceive something, you always perceive it as something else. When you perceive it as something else, that is to say, you know, you perceive the thing, your object, as a tennis ball. When you do that, what you're doing is you're obviously classifying the object you're seeing. You're predicating a property of it. Now, one picture, of course, of what goes on in perception is that it's a little bit like belief. You have an independent grasp of what the property of the class is, and you're simply taking this object you perceive and assigning it to that class. That's an indirect, in standard terminology, picture, so to speak, a representational picture, is sometimes called, of perception. I don't like that picture. I prefer a more direct sort of picture, often called naive realism or direct realism, about the property you're perceiving as well. And it goes back to the topic that I covered the last day in talking about exemplification. So what I said in that case, if you take a color like that, you take a color property, and you may say to me, now, you said black, but, you know, there are many blacks, you know. This is a dusky sort of black. You know, what sort of black? And I say, that sort of black. Now, what am I doing? I'm holding up an instance of a property, here, an instance of black, and I'm using it to exemplify a larger class, which may come in slightly different shades or may come in different sorts of surfaces, reflectance properties, and so on. I'm using it as an example. And as, you know, Goodman argued long ago, examples can represent, you know, when they exemplify, when they're taken to take you to the wider class. How do they do that? Well, in most cases, it seems to me, by what is often called prolepsis. We see a particular shape, let's suppose, a triangle, maybe a series of triangles of different sizes, and I say, that's the shape I'm interested in. There are different triangles. I say, not those, and I point in the shapes that are not triangles. I take it that when you see examples of triangles, you've got a natural disposition we all have to extrapolate in a certain direction, and given these are different shapes and sizes and so on, to extrapolate to a very broad class where it doesn't matter what the shape or the size is. And I take it that insofar as we're disposed to extrapolate in that way, we can see the particular triangle presented as exemplifying that larger class, and thereby, as well, serving a representational, but put that in inverted commas if you like, role. So my image of directly perceiving properties in perception is that you see something as having a certain property. There's an instance of that property there, but the instance of the property there is serving a dual role. It both directs you to the truth condition, as it were, of the perception. It directs you to the similarity class in which you're placing this particular object. But it's also, of course, the truth maker. It is also what makes it the case that this object belongs to that class. So the picture is that perception is always, it's assigning things to classes, or at least a lot of the time. Even, I take it, these are assumptions that are true. I'm going to assume of at least many non-human animals and unspeaking animals. I don't see why they shouldn't be. So that, for example, when you take a pigeon, and I understand you can condition a pigeon on triangular doors, to take that case, it will peck at a triangular door, but not at other doors, regardless of the size, up to presumably a certain limit or shape of the triangle. Now, at that point, presumably, when the pigeon sees a particular triangle, given it's conditioned on that, and in a way that's independent of the particularities of the triangle presented, independent of the shape or the size up to a certain limit, it can take the triangle presented as, so to speak, exemplifying the very similarity class into which it is placing this object, and so peck, you know, as it pecks at it, having perceived it as a triangle. So I think perception is direct in both of these ways. You directly perceive objects and the properties you perceive them as having, as we put it. And those properties you perceive them as having are not sort of brought from elsewhere to the perception, as in conceptually or whatever. They're revealed in the perception itself, so that it's direct in this second dimension too. The second feature or assumption I want to make about perception is that it's intentional. Like, you know, there are many different theories of intention. I've been desperately reading over them over the last little while, but I think these comments are consistent with at least many of them. And the comments I want to make are fairly obvious, that in perception, even the dog, think of my dog Dougal, right? When Dougal is, when I throw a tennis ball for Dougal, you know, and he doesn't quite see where I threw it, I just make the motion and he sees my hand is gone, and now he looks, right? And he scans. Of course, there'll be a lot of involuntary saccading, but presumably also a lot of intentional movement of the focus of intention as he moves his head and changes position, as he moves from one sense to another, even sniffs, so to speak, as well as looks, or pecks up the ears, as in hearing. I take it that he is doing something intentional, intended, which involves changing what perception is going to reveal to him, assuming that it's veridical. And if he does it well, at a certain point, bang, you know, he hears a noise, or he sees a ball, or smells it, whatever he does, and, you know, he homes in. So he can get information about where exactly the ball is. But on the basis of this intentional, intended activity, or at least potential, certainly controlled by intention, as in even if it's automatic, presumably, even a simple animal like the dog can actually, out of a desire to find the ball, can actually monitor and control what's happening in the otherwise involuntary sort of movement of the head or whatever. The third feature of perception, I'm just going to assume, is that it's disallowable. And what I mean by that is that the normal role, I take it, of perception is to engender belief. It sort of, it brings you to believe that things are thus and so. Rightly, if it's a veridical perception, of course perception need not be veridical. And even with a simple animal, I think it's plausible that the animal will not form beliefs when experience is revealed that the perception is not veridical. So I'm sorry, I'm going to introduce you to Dougal. He's a lovely mixture of a poodle and a schnauzer, a schnoodle. And so one feature of this animal with whom you're going to feel very intimate at the end of this lecture is that when he was a puppy and we brought him into a room where there's a full-size mirror, he got very excited about the mirror. I mean, there was another dog there, you know. He went over and began licking the mirror. He went around and looked at the other side of the mirror. And he barked, of course, at the mirror. And the dog barked back, what's more, you know. But at a certain point, Dougal got it. I mean, or at least he realized that there was nothing to get. And he just stopped barking at the mirror. He just doesn't notice it. Now he's 1.5 years old. He just doesn't notice the dog in the mirror. It's just not there for him. Now, I don't think that Dougal, or at least you don't have to assume, that the dog has come to form the belief, that's not a dog. Looks like a dog, but it's not a dog, you know. It doesn't have to be internal negation, so to speak, in the content of the belief. I believe that is not a dog. But of course, there can be external negation, as in he just doesn't believe it's a dog anymore. the perception has been, so to speak, demobilized, decommissioned, you know, taken away from its normal role in engendering belief. And I think that has to be a feature of perception, that while it is predicative or classificatory, to mention that first one, even in this direct way, while it involves, it's so to speak, layered with intentional activity and in changing the focus, it still, as a whole process, can be neutralized, so to speak, insulated from belief formation under appropriate circumstances. Now, those three assumptions, as I think of them, they're assumptions that I believe are true of basically most perceiving creatures or animals, including us, of course. They don't require language as I see it, so hence I can use Dougal as an example. Someone may say, but look, wait a moment, you know nothing or very little or just at second hand about animals. And I confess, alas, that's true, apart from my intimate acquaintance with Dougal and various other dogs throughout my life. But if that worries you, that it's not, I'm not informing this presentation with a lot of empirical detail from the vast literature on animal minds, from my point of view, it's fine if we're just talking about a possible sort of mind. That's going to still work for the point of view of this argument. Okay, so now we have characterized, maybe just a possible mind, the idea of a perceiver with these three features, who may be a reasoned perceiver or a non-reasoned perceiver. It may be that the perceiver, like us, can reason from perception or not. All three assumptions are still going to hold. Next question is, let's think about what it might be for the unreasoned or unreasoning perceiver. A creature like my, maybe it's imaginary picture of Dougal. Well, here's one thought that might immediately spring to mind if you've been at both of the earlier lectures, which is the following. In the last lecture, I contrasted what I called blind transitioning, which is still rational transitioning, with reasoned transitioning. Now, blind transitioning is what I mentioned earlier, as in, you know, you believe P and if P then Q, and bang, you don't know why, you find yourself believing that Q. I talked about a possible, you know, form that this might assume, as in the idiot savant, you know, who, remember I mentioned the example which I happen to have seen somewhere on, I think, on the BBC or YouTube, where you've got someone trying to, they're asked, two people, one is an idiot savant, the other is a mathematician, as to what day of the week the 27th of April 1923 was. The premise is supplied there, it's a particular date and so on, and there's a conclusion to be drawn, was it a Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, or Saturday. I mean, those are the possible conclusions. And the mathematician, you know, worries away, does some computations, and about 5 minutes later comes up with the answer, I believe it's a Thursday. But the idiot savant, who, at least in this presentation, I know nothing about the idiot savant, I should say, in general, looking completely sort of spaced out, says simply, Thursday, you know, like a flash. Now, presumably, he didn't reason to that conclusion. Presumably, it just came to him, you know. That's blind transitioning. Okay, so you might think that if the creature like Dougal doesn't reason from perception to the tennis ball is there or whatever, I can smell it, which just, you know, goes for the tennis ball on the basis of its perceptual inputs, maybe it's like the blind transitioning. Maybe it just, perceptions occur, they're momentary events or a sequence of events, and bang, it has a belief. As it were, it doesn't know, it knows not why. And actually, that's interesting because it corresponds to the phenomenon that Lawrence Weisskranz described in this university back in the 1960s or 60s as blindsight, which has been much talked about and talked up and no doubt artificialized, as it were, fictionalized by philosophers. The idea of the blind side, I mean, the simple case given is someone who claims not to see anything in their right hemisphere, let's suppose, sees things here, fine, can't see anything here, but then asked, well, if there were something there, you know, hands like, what do you think it is? And they say fairly reliably, a glass, right? So though they don't, or they can, you know, the idea would be if they're fully blindsighted, they would walk across a room without claiming not to see anything, but not crash into anything in the way, not walk into a table or whatever. If there were blind transitioning of the kind that I'm asking about now, if that's what's happening in Dougal, then Dougal would be blind-sighted, indeed blind-sensed, as it were, if you can think of it as an overall condition. This description of blind-sense, by the way, is pulling far away from the actual empirical literature, which is much contested, very detailed, there are only a few cases, and so on. And that seems all wrong, doesn't it? I mean, it seems wrong to think that the dog is just forming beliefs in this blind sort of way. I think in particular it doesn't do justice to the phenomenon of attention. Because after all, Dougal, when I throw the ball, he knows it's gone somewhere, he doesn't know if it's there or there, that could be in the bushes or whatever, and he now performs certain intentional activities, moving its head, you know, sniffing the wind, running in the direction, get nearer where it might be, and then sniffing and so on. And maybe listening as the ball is still rolling or whatever. In that case, the animal is performing intentional activity, intended activity, which reliably produces the result that it, in this particular case, it learns things about its environment. It forms true beliefs about its environment. Now, insofar as the animal gains those, so to speak, rewards as a result of this activity, it's very plausible to think that Dougal and any such animal, even if we're talking about just a possibility rather than actual animals, it's very plausible that we should think of his attentional activity as an activity aimed at giving him beliefs about matters he needs to have beliefs about, aimed at giving him information. And if that's the case, it seems to me false to think of the creature as operating with blindsight. It's not as if things happen, you know, that don't register at all with the animal, with the creature, that then elicit a certain belief. He knows not why, as it were. On the contrary, Dougal is doing various things that actively elicit the belief. It's not that they come upon him, so to speak, from outside by accident. He's actually eliciting them by virtue of his intentional activity. It's no surprise to him, as it were, that the ball is there where he heard the noise, or he smelled the smell, or he saw the object. So I want to say that with even unreasoned perceivers of this kind that I'm trying to characterize, it would be wrong to think of them as super blindsighted or blindsighted, blindsensed in any way, because of the intentional activity involved in paying attention. But notice, on this picture, they're still not reasoning. Dougal is not reasoning about, I heard it there, now it'll only sound, and there's a smell, yeah, I bet it's over there. He's not reasoning, nor is reasoning controlling what he's doing. He's just intentionally seeking out information, though how he conceives it is another issue, and it's generating the beliefs in response. So you've got three models now. One is the blind sight model, the blind transition model, which may well apply, say, with the simple robot we were talking about in the case of belief to belief transitions. And at the other extreme, you've got the reasoning model, where you really have a question. You think these premises will provide the basis of an answer. You think about the premises. You don't just believe in the premises. You form beliefs about them, holding them as an object of attention. You find yourself driven to the belief that you express in SOQ, That's the other extreme. But in between is this that is neither blind sight nor reasoning. And I think of that as a model, a potential model at any rate, of what animal perceptual consciousness might be like. One way of summing that up, actually, is to say that it's very plausible to say with the blind-sighted imaginary creature, let's suppose, blind-sensed creature that just forms beliefs, acts on them, but there's no sort of connection of the kind we say, we allege when we think of the person being aware of why they form belief or what pressed them to it. We can say with such a creature that there's nothing the world is like for them. I mean, they form beliefs about the world, and those beliefs maybe inform their actions and guide them, maybe even quite reliably. But there's nothing the world is like for them. It doesn't show up for them. It's as if it's operating as we might say, in the dark, but in the dark of all senses, you know? Her beliefs are just driving its behavior, but there's nothing of which it, as we say, is aware coming in. That's plausible, I say. It's very hard to argue this in a very exact way, but I'm trying to evoke that intuition. And by contrast, there's something the world is like for Dougal, you know? Because Dougal is aware of looking for cues and so on, bang, going for a cue, going for a conclusion, as it were, and then acting on the basis of it. That world is constantly, and he's actively interacting and registering that world. So it's very plausible to say there's something the world is like for Dougal. So that's very positive. But just to put in a negative twist now, when you think about Dougal's world, or the world maybe of any of a whole range of animals, the animal may be very actively engaged and aware of the world, not blind-sensed, and responding to it and taking overtures that, so to speak, inform and elicit appropriate beliefs on the basis of which it can act and so on. All of that may be true, and just as you might put it, the animal may be totally immersed in the experience and lost in the experience. After all, the Dougal we're imagining is not aware of believing versus perceiving. Perceiving, in a way, is believing, except in the mirror case, you know, where the perception is, so to speak, insulated from the, demobilized, as I put it, decommissioned. But otherwise, there's no contrast for him between perceiving is, what is it really like? What am I to believe? No, perceiving doesn't contrast with believing. He's totally immersed in that perceptual world, even though he's quite active in exploring that perceptual world. He doesn't have any abstract questions. I wonder whether P or Q, that he then goes to perception to answer, so to speak. Perception is just something he works with. It's how the world is. For Dougal, as it were. And the main thing to register is that the perceived world just is the world. There's no gap between the perceived world and the world in itself, so to speak, for a creature of those limited conceptual reasoning capacities. So it's still the world is there's something it's like for Dougal, and that means we can, so to speak, thrill to the joy of a young animal, you know, in running across a field or in chasing a ball or whatever, as we all do. You know, we're obviously sharing something with that animal. That is, this is not a mere sort of mechanical robot or whatever without there being anything the world is like for it. The world is obviously a very rich way for any animal of that kind, especially, of course, when you realize its smell is much more powerful than ours, you know, with various birds. There are a whole range of colors it sees that we don't see. Dougal recently got a toy, you know, which he loves squeezing because it produces a noise that he hears, but we can't hear. It's a wonderful idea if you've got a dog for a toy. It's a very rich world that Dougal has, but it's a world in which, as I think of it, he may well be, for all we know, as we're lost, so immersed as to have no bearings on it. He's just, okay. So let's move on to reasoned perception and consciousness. Now, I think with creatures of my imaginary people who have come, who have developed language, that language is going to evoke capacities to reason in them. And I want to say that the reasoning that can control then their perception can really introduce quite a novel dimension to consciousness itself. So here's one thing that we, or they, and I'll talk about we for simplicity, can do as a result of being able to, as a result of being able to reason. Well, taking the tennis ball you're holding in the dark, you know, you can think about the, it's not just that there are various properties that register with you, even and that you categorize it in terms of, in the exemplificational way, it's not just that. You can actually think about these properties. You can think, well, it's got that fluffy sort of feel, you know, and it's round, okay, and maybe you bounce it, and I know that sound, you know, I've watched Wimbledon often enough on television or whatever, and then you smell it, you know, it's got that rubbery sort of smell, and you think, of course, it's a tennis ball, right? There you've reasoned the conclusion, but notice, by virtue of being able to reason, of course you won't do this normally, but it'll obviously be there in the background in the standby way, you can control in that sense what your perceptual transitions are to belief, you can focus on the different properties, right? And notice not only the different properties, but also properties associated with different sensory organs. So, you know, the smell was one thing, another was the feel, you know, touch, another was the sound, another was... You finally turn on the lights. Of course it's a tennis ball. Any idiot can see it's a tennis ball. You know, eyes are much better with many of these things, as we know. So you can, by virtue of reasoning, the first feature the, relating to the directness, so to speak, is that you can distinguish the properties that are relevant to your forming certain beliefs and really think about them and think about whether they really do elicit those beliefs, as we will say, whether they support those beliefs. And that's something, of course, that Dougal... or the imaginary Dougal can't do. Secondly, with attention, Dougal moves around. I mean, his focus shifts all the time, and it's directed by, where's the ball, you know? In that sense, by a purpose, so it's intentional. But with us, we can actually, knowing that we can attend in that way, we can actually ask questions of... because of being able to reason, we can ask questions of our perception, as in, I wonder if it's a, you know, or is it a tennis ball or is it a cricket ball, for example? We can ask a question like that, and we can bring the question to our perceptual resources, so to speak, and force them to answer the question. Not only that, we can introduce all sorts of judgmental distinctions we make in language that actually... we weren't perceptually salient, sensitive to, and make them matters of perceptual salience. So, for example, you learn what Art Deco is, you know? And man, you can see the Art Deco, non-Art Deco distinction all over the place. You know, you can recognize an Art Deco sort of object. You can see something as an Art Deco piece of sculpture or whatever it might be. And similarly for a whole range of distinctions like that, I mean, associated, for example, traditionally with the theory ladenness of observation, you know, as in the, and we talked about that example earlier, you know, the radiologist who will just look at an X-ray and see it as displaying a growth or a tumor or nothing of that kind or whatever, where the rest of us are just lost. We can train up our perceptions. Our perception can be more skillful in that way by virtue of our bringing, letting them interact with our verbal resources, our resources of judgment. And that's a very big leap, as the first aspect is a leap beyond the conscious capacities of Dougal. The third one is probably, and now we move to the DA, the third D, disallowable, is probably the most important of all. Because we can equally recognize that perceptions are sometimes not veridical. So we can think about the properties that we perceive things as having as properties they may not really have. The stick looks bent. It's got the perceptual property of being bent, but we know from experience it isn't bent. So we can distinguish between how things are perceived to be and how they are. And that's something I think that is conspicuously missing in my little vignette, so to speak, of Dougal's psychology. We can not just, like Dougal, decommission perception. We can come to say, well, that looks like a dog, but it isn't a dog. It's a reflection that looks bent, but it isn't bent. And thereby we can distinguish between, as it were, the world in itself and the world as it's perceived to be. Now, most of the time, and I think the default assumption with perception is the world is as it's perceived to be. But let the red flags go up, you know, as in you reach for the stick and you realize where you reached, it's not there. Let the red flags go up and you begin to see this. And of course, with interpersonal communication, different perspectives, different people, it underlines the possibility of the world as it is being different from the world as you perceive it to be. Now, it seems to me that what this leads us to is a thought that where there's something the world is like for Dougal, that's true for us, of course, as well, there's something extra that's true for us, which is that there's also something it's like to be in a state of perceiving the world to be such and such. Not that the world, not just that the world is, there's something the world is like for us, unlike for the blind-sighted creature. It's also that there's something it's like for us to be in a state of perception of the world being thus and so. Because once we're aware of our perceptions, in whatever modality, overall, perhaps together, once we're aware of them being potentially non-veridical, we're aware of it, the perceptual state, so to speak, as the potential bearer of various properties. Well, what properties? Here what I'm trying to say is this. I was feeling the tennis ball, right, in my hand. And I said, it's fluffy. But of course, recognizing that my perception, this may be an illusion, let's suppose, induced by a neuroscientist, you know, with his little machine on the other side of the room, I can think, well, insofar as the ball is fluffy by my perception, I can think of my perception having the quality of being as of something fluffy, or my smell being, you know, smelling as of something rubbery, or my, when I hear something, you know, and I wonder, what is that sound? I can hear it when I hear it, let's suppose, as a bird in the distance, and once I hear it that way and then realize, well, you know, maybe I'm being deceived. I'm still aware that the perception has the property of being as of a bird in the distance, right? So for every property perceived and ascribed to objects perceptually, there's going to be a corresponding, as it were, as of property that belongs and you can think of as belonging to the perceptual state. And insofar as you're aware of your perceivings as having these as-of properties, you can be, there can be something it's like to perceive things that way. You can conceive of what's happening in that manner. So there's something it's like for you to perceive things to be that way. And of course, we can play in this way, as in going into virtual reality machines or IMAX cinemas or whatever that induce, as we know, various of these non-veridical experiences. We can almost wallow in those perceptual states, you know, enjoying these properties, these as of properties that the state is going to have, enjoying the vertigo, the as of falling, you know, from a skyscraper or whatever in the virtual reality machine. The state can assume a salience for you that leads me to say there's something it's like to be in that sort of state. Okay, so this takes me really to the last section. So what I've seen is, I think as a result of having language capacity to reason, reasoning in particular from perception, there has to be some sense of consciousness we have of our, in our perception. I've talked about perception, these three assumptions about how even an unreasoned perception, our perceiver, like Dougal. There'll be something the world is like, and this reasoning is going to, or this control by reasoning is going to introduce another possibility altogether, that there's something it's like to be in that state. But now the big question, and this is really where we get into the terrain where it's now much, much fought over in the consciousness literature, is, and really a Euthyphro question distinguishes, as I think of it, the two sides. So one side, when I said there's something the state is like, it's like to be in that state. Another way of saying that is the state is a sort of feel, you know, or a quale, you know, in the technical term. Now the Euthyphro question, this is the last section, the Euthyphro question is this. Am I guided by the perception, say, in recognizing this is a fluffy ball, by the quale? Is the quale there, so to speak, as the guide, as the driver of how I perceive things to be? Or is it the other way around? Is it the case that the perception gains that quale in virtue of its being a perceiver, a perception of things being thus and so? An example I like that I've written about elsewhere, which I think brings out these two possibilities, is I've called it here akinetopsia. So akinetopsia is a condition in which people do not see apparent motion. So they see things moving as if they were in a stroboscopic room or working under stroboscopic lighting. You know, they see things jumping from place to place, but they do not see, they see things as if, you know, it's a cinema where the film is running too slowly, you know, so you're not being led into. Okay, so imagine someone like Jackson's Mary, I think I call her Eva, who's in a stroboscopic room, and she comes out of the stroboscopic room. In the stroboscopic room, she can tell where everything is. She can do all of the computations and so on, but she just doesn't see anything moving. Even her hand, you know, seems to go jumpily as she writes or does her computations. She comes out and suddenly she can see things that are moving. Now, she now can identify where the ball is going to be in a moment. She can grab for it and so on. She could do all of that with the computation in the room as well. But there's a new quale, isn't there? We'll all say that. There's a new quale to seeing things move. And you know, there's some moving descriptions. Sorry, don't mean to pun on moving. There's some nice descriptions of people who recovered from akinetopsia, you know, being exhilarated by the sense of the world they have, and suddenly things are moving, you know? It's like the cinema, you know, they've suddenly made the projector run faster again. So here's the question with akinetopsia. When Eva comes out of that room, does she suddenly have a quale come on stream, called the sense of apparent motion, which then lets her, enables her to see things moving in this fluid way? Or is it that as a result of now having whatever the neural repair or circuitry put right that was gone wrong, and being able to read off the positions of things in this more or less continuous way, is the quale a result of that? You know, is it the precipitate of that? So is it the case that I'm guided by things in determining that's moving, it'll be there and so on, by how it looks, by the quality of the experience? Or is it that in being able to do that, that's what it is to have the quality, the property in your perception of being as of apparent motion? Those are the two divides. And of course, as where people like Galen and Dave Chalmers, they go very much for the quale is something intrinsic, it's a feature of the perception, it plays a role in enabling the perception, and that means that now it seems there's a property that's not directly explicable by what's happened physically, at least not, it isn't a logical entailment of what happens. Whereas on the other view, no, quale is just what it's like for a subject who can actually now read off things like apparent motion. To put it in terms of, you know, color, I see a red object. And one view will say that my sensation, our visual sensations, are sort of reddishness. Think of that as an intrinsic quality of the perception. And it's a result of that that I see things as red. The other will say, no, no, red is a purely physical property that is controlled in various ways and registered by your eye. It's a spectral reflectance, let's say. But in being able to detect things by color and being able to track things in virtue of their color, which involves a whole range of neural capacities that we're only beginning to really identify and separate out, by virtue of being able to do that, it's remarkably complex at the neural level. Things are going to look red, of course. That's the way they look when you are making that sort of judgment. Now, I'm inclined, but I'm just going to lay this out as a view I tend towards, or I find attractive rather than a view I can defend. I'm very attracted by the view that the quality comes from the ability, so to speak, to make the judgments, the discriminations, and so on. That when you're able to distinguish just by sight where something is moving, where it's likely to be, you're going to have a quale as of apparent motion, which in itself can be quite exciting, rather than the other way around. I mean, the reason for going this way is it's more parsimonious, it seems to me, as a view of, so to speak, what happens in the world. It's also, it seems to me these quale are, they're very suspect entities anyhow. So, you know, how something looks, it's looking like it's moving, or it looks like it's red, or it's got the look of a tennis ball. When you ask about this look, which is supposed to be this intrinsic feature of the perception, and then you ask, well, how does the look itself look? You realize that's a silly question. No, things look, and the way they look is tied with, and the look isn't, so to speak, if it were independent, you sort of feel, well, couldn't you just pull it apart from, you know, the thing you're seeing in virtue of having that in your perception, and then think about it? But, and this is, people often call this the diaphaneity, I suppose, of perception. There seems to be nothing in your hands. There seems to be nothing there in place of the quality other than how things are presenting them to you insofar as you are capable of perceiving them in this rich, judgmentally oriented, reason-controlled way that I've been describing. Another reason is that we have a familiar notion of an affordance, great term of Gibson, the psychologist, someone I particularly like, which are qualities that things display for us perceptually as we're in virtue of being able to do something with them. You know, we look at the hammer and we can almost reach for it. Actually, that sounds more Heidegger than Gibson, but they're sort of in the same ballpark, I guess, on this topic. It's not a mysterious idea that things might have, well, in the case of perception, it'll be a sort of inferential. I see a perception, it's cueing me to, it's make a certain inference, you know, it's eliciting from me that inference to a belief, and that's what it is for the perception to have a certain quality. That's what it is for things to look a certain way to me. I have another consideration here, actually, which I'll just briefly mention. I've only got about 3 or 4 minutes' time. Ivo Kohler, in the 1930s, did an extended series of experiments in Austria, which Gibson took up actually later and popularized in the 1980s. And one of them was an experiment by getting people, you'd never get away with it now, no ethics committee would pass it, to wear glasses which had a blue hue on one side and a yellow hue on the other, and had a green on the upside and a red on the bottom. So, I mean, their world was a buzz with color of a crazy sort. Now, they quickly learned to adjust at the level of judgment, as I would put it. As in, okay, I know it looks green over there, but, you know, focusing on it, it's not green, and it obviously hasn't changed color, that's a sort. So you just learn to ignore, and it's laborious, you know. It's very, very tough. It's like learning to drive a car. You've got to think, now, wait a minute, I move up and I wait for that sound and so on. But here's the amazing thing. as people got better and better at making those judgments, things began to look normal again. And after a number of weeks, these people said, it's disappeared. I've lost this effect. I don't have the blue-green sort of switching thing, the red-green, the blue-yellow switching effect at all. It's just fine. It was fine until they took off the glasses, and of course the effect returned, or a mirror image, I think, of the effect, and it had to be... Which is, that suggests to me is that by learning to read off from the perceived world according to a certain pattern, the perceptions, the looks, the qualia fell into line. I mean, that's, none of this is knocked down, as I say, and I don't mean it to be. Now, I'll just finish with one comment. There are two very insistent arguments presented in the literature. One is called the epistemic argument, the other the modal argument, for, so to speak, the emergence or the special non-physical character of qualia and of consciousness in general. One is the epistemic argument is the Mary argument, you know, that if you imagine Mary in the black and white room, that's Frank Jackson's Mary, and now you let her out, and isn't she going to have just see completely new sort of things, a big aha experience? And doesn't that show you that there's a quale that comes on stream there, you know? That isn't just explained by the fact she can make discriminations now that she couldn't make before, at least with greater ease. The other intuition, the modal argument, is one that David Chalmers has run in particular, which is that, look, think about any capacity like the capacity to see apparent motion. Isn't that just neural circuitry of various kinds operating? And can't you imagine that functioning going on without there being any consciousness? Those are the two arguments. I think those arguments, there's a very nice response of Victoria McGeers, who's in the audience, and I don't support this just for reasons of domestic bliss. her argument, she pointed out some years ago, is that these undercut one another. Because suppose that you believe the Mary argument, think, yeah, that really hammers it. But then that undermines the zombie argument, because if you imagine the zombie is supposed to be, I call it the modal argument, the zombie argument is supposed to be someone functionally exactly like you, but without any consciousness. But now if you think Mary's aha shows she had a quale, and now you're thinking about the zombie over there in the possible world, that zombie, of course, is going to say aha as well, is going to, otherwise it won't be a zombie, speech is a product of our functioning. But then you're going to say, well, wait a moment, the zombies, if I trust Mary's aha, I've got to trust the zombie's aha. So the zombie argument isn't a good argument, right, if I accept the... And it works the other way around. Suppose you're persuaded by the zombie argument, as in you could have a zombie just functioning like us, it would say, aha, it would say it's very excited and so on, but it'd just be all functioning, there'd be no quale, that's John's claim. Well, if you think that's true, why are you so persuaded by Mary? Because after all, Mary might be a zombie, you know, who's just going through the motions of saying aha and so on, where there's no quale in there. So it seems to me these arguments leave me unpersuaded. And, you know, that's why I go for the more parsimonious view, or at least tend in that direction. But my main goal has been to try to persuade you that speech is very powerful, and the capacity to speech is very powerful, not just in catalyzing in creatures who don't necessarily have those capacities beforehand, a capacity to judge and intentionally form beliefs on certain issues, a capacity to reason, not just blindly transition, but also this capacity to be aware of their perceptions as the perceived world is not necessarily the actual world, and to have something that goes with it, which is something it's like to be in that perceptual state, which I think need not involve an irreducible quale of the Chalmers Strawson kind. Just in conclusion, I'd say that this, of course, is only me talking about perceptual consciousness. There's an issue of consciousness in many areas in bodily sensation, and I've said nothing on them. Thank you very much.